Committee.
On the other two.
Thank you, Bob. Well done.
Yeah.
Representative, we want the committee.
Let me tell you how.
The committee would like to thank Representative Lynn for her search and rescue mission. Still a soldier, ever a soldier. So House Judiciary Committee is in session at 1:45. In attendance to Representative Gatto, Representative Holmes, Representative Dahlstrom, Representative Ramirez, Representative Herron, Representative Lynn, Representative Grunberg is standing by on the Transportation Committee, which is regularly scheduled now, and wishes to vote on the first piece of business we have before us, which is HJR 35. The chair would like to recognize that Representative Kelly and Derek Miller are here to present. We'd also like to recognize our former colleague, Andrea Dahl, is in the room. It's a pleasure to have you back here, Representative Dahl. Representative Kelly, the floor is yours.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill today. And at this stage of a 90-day session, brevity is mercy, so I shall be brief.
Amen. And, introduce yourself first, though.
Yes, I am. My name is Representative Mike Kelly, District 7, Fairbanks. And I have with me my staffer, Derek Miller.
Mr. A+.
We have a couple of folks on online with us as well, Mr. Chairman. This bill, the HJR 35, the Healthcare Freedoms Act, needs to be viewed in a larger context, and I think you're all aware of that, and that is the effort in Washington to nationalize healthcare to one degree or another. And when we look at the situation with healthcare, there are three things that we're after. We're after access, affordability, and quality. And in looking at the national scene, the majority of Americans are at least not yet rallying around the national bill as a way to get to any of the three of those. And with our, just to take one, the access, our Medicare population is growing faster than any other state except one, which is the state of Nevada, and this bill will not increase their access. In fact, it takes money away from Medicare. The affordability piece, the Congressional Budget Office has also opined that it will raise costs, not reduce them. And on the final piece, quality, if you ever found anyone going for a service to government to increase quality, I would be surprised. So it is in the spirit of this larger context that we bring the Healthcare Freedoms Act, and about 35 states are in a similar mood on this. And what this bill would do would be protect two essential rights. First, it would protect a person's right to choose to participate or not to participate in a healthcare system, and would prohibit the government from imposing fines or penalties on the person because of that decision. Secondly, it would protect the right of an individual to purchase themselves and the right of doctors to provide lawful medical services, and would prevent the government from imposing fines or penalties for the person making that choice. Some folks have stated that this may set us on a collision course with the federal government, and that is entirely possible. And all of the 35 states involved understand the potential that if there is a forced national system, and we have this law passes in the state, if the people choose to pass it as a constitutional amendment, it could set the stage for a battle. But we would certainly have a number of friends in the 35 states, and that number will undoubtedly increase. So, Mr. Chairman, I think with that, I will state that that's simply what this will do.
Very good. Before we ask the sponsor any questions, I want to recognize that Representative Gatto is also a prime sponsor of this bill, and you enjoy two other co-sponsors here in the committee, Representative Lynn and myself. Wishing to testify in the room are Peggy Ann McConaughey with the NFIB, our former colleague, Representative Andrea Dahl, who is with the Alaska Retired Public Employees. Pat Luby is here with the AARP, or she's all online with the AARP, and Dave Rowland with the Show Me Institute, and also Christy Herrera with the American Legislative Exchange Council. So with that, are there any questions for the sponsor? Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And having heard this bill in a prior committee, this, I'm pretty sure the sponsor is going to be familiar with the area of my, one of the areas of my concern. Just wanted to give the sponsor an opportunity to respond and also put it on the record so others who are testifying. One of the main concerns I have with this is it would cause problems. I understand it wouldn't apply to existing programs, but any amendments to things like Medicare, VA benefits, tribal health, there are a lot of programs like that that I'm very afraid that if this were to pass and become part of our Constitution could have severe negative effects on some of those programs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Simply stated, and we've got folks far better than I following me to testify that that question could be posed to, but the I offer this bill in full recognition that it places on the individual the right to choose. And so if someone does come along to impose something on a citizen of Alaska against their will relative to their seeking medical care for their own body, I make no apologies for that. That's is something, though, as to the detail that the two folks that are online would be able to help you there. Through the chair, Representative Holmes.
Thank you.
And just a piece of housekeeping, we're a standing committee that meets Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, and have, by consent of the committee, have agreed to meet on Thursdays. The Transportation Committee meets on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So Representative Gruenberg is attending his other standing committee obligation and has expressed a wish to vote on HJR 35. So after we have wound up public testimony and prior to a vote, we'll take an at ease. And Gretchen and his staff will go get Representative Gruenberg so that he can cast a vote on this, just so we understand kind of the mechanism. Any other questions for the bill sponsor? Very good. Representative Kelly?
Chairman, I have another bill up in transportation, the committee you just mentioned, so I'm going to stick with you, but when I bail out, it's not because someone said something.
Well, when you go down there, give Representative Gruenberg just a kind of a sense of what is going on. Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just on the fiscal note, it says if it requires an 8.5 by 18 inch ballot, the cost will increase to $22,000. That's a big ballot. Is that mean?
It's a 2,000-page bill. And growing.
Does that require the entire ballot be dedicated to just the language in this one bill, or can that $22,000 be shared among several of these amendments?
Citizens call too. I don't know. I've got it through the chair. Derek from your staff to find that out for you. Is it $22,000 or is it
$2,000? $22,000, yeah. $1,500 for the booklet, and then to print the ballot, 8.5 by 18 is $22,000. So if you had a ballot and I had a ballot, do we each pay $22,000 or do we share it and pay $11,000 each, put it on one ballot in two different places?
Through the chair, we will find out.
Roger that.
Won't affect my vote, but I'm a little bit curious.
We all have that sensitivity. Any other questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, it was a pleasure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. All right, let's go to the folks that are in the room. Peggy Ann, are you here?
Yes,
welcome. We're delighted to have you here. If you'll introduce yourself and the affiliation for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Peggy Ann McConaughey, and I live and work in Juneau, Alaska. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be able to testify today, and thank you very much for being co-sponsors. I surely appreciate it, as does my husband and other NFIB members. My husband and I own three small businesses. One of the businesses is a tour business, operates approximately 6 months out of the year, has about 30 employees, part-time, full-time, and they are comprised of teenagers, college students, teachers, retirees. The other business, which was just opened on March 1st, has four employees. If the mandated system of health care goes in as prescribed by the federal government, it could be well, we could be well out of business for at least two out of our three businesses. We understand and believe fully that the problems with the health care has to do with cost, has to do with affordability, has to do with portability, and also has to do with tort reform. None of those items are solved by the government's push in their health care bill. My husband's from New Zealand, where they have a system similar to what the federal government would like to employ. Let me tell you from firsthand experience, it doesn't work. I could tell you intimately why it doesn't work, but it doesn't. As far as the pre-existing conditions, nobody wants more than me to have pre-existing conditions dealt with. I have one, but I'm here to tell you today that I have health insurance. It may be a little costly, but once again, the federal government's mandates do not necessarily fix that. I think we need to look for an Alaska solution, something that works for Alaskans, and that's why I'm so excited about the possibility of getting on the ballot an amendment that would explicitly give individuals the right to health care and free choice. Cost and access has always been something Alaskans are concerned about, but that's something that Alaskans can work with. The mandates that are included currently in the federal bills clearly impose unreasonable burdens on Alaskans and Alaskan businesses, especially small businesses like ours. The mandates that are imposed cannot and will not help Alaskans. We want to protect small businesses from being taxed for not providing health care insurance designed by the federal government that doesn't work for Alaskans. I strongly urge you to pass HJR 35, and I look forward to being able to vote on it in the near future. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Peggy Ann? Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If it were to turn out that this would make it difficult to make any changes in the future to the Medicare, VA, or tribal health, would that be a concern to you?
Well, through the chair, frankly, I don't know enough about those to be necessarily able to answer it from a perspective of a small business owner, one who's trying to control costs. Every day we have new taxes that we have to be levied, whether it's through the state, whether it's through the city or the federal government. Small businesses are getting hit in every direction. What I'd say is let's look at ways that, if those are concerns, so we can deal with it. But for goodness sakes, let's help us out in this particular instance, and let's not drive more small businesses out of business.
Other questions? Again, we thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Representative Dahl, we're so happy to have you. What a privilege. We always enjoy you.
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm Andrea Dahl, and I'm serving as the chair of the Legislative Information Committee for the Alaska Retired Public Employees. And the RPEA has 2,200 members.
Interesting.
And I have to say that I probably heard from a lot of them this morning asking me to come and talk about this bill.
Interesting.
You know, the prospect of a national public health plan imposed on individuals has made people either happy or very fearful. So fear most often generates an exaggerated response. And RPEA feels that HJR 35 is an example of an exaggerated response. HJR proposes to amend the Alaska Constitution, and I think this is the real point behind all the calls that I received. Because what would be the consequences? One of the unintended consequences of this action would be to tie the hands of current legislators, as well as future ones, from tackling Alaska's health care issues. It could also prevent lawmakers from assessing a full array of options. Closing off options is short-sighted, and especially as we, the public, have no idea what the final national legislation on health care reform is even going to look like. So to take this step is not the right one at this moment. Keeping federal government out of health care may be a political philosophy and could also appeal to a significant sector of the population. But taking steps to amend the Constitution is radical and potentially harmful. On behalf of RPEA, we're asking you to reconsider this and to defeat this resolution as it stands at this time. And I thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dahl. So nice to have you here. A couple of questions. Who pays the premiums for the Alaska retired public employees?
Who pays them?
Uh-huh.
retired public employees. They are part of, as you know, they're part of a pension system.
So who pays the premiums?
The state.
Oh, the state of Alaska does?
Yes.
So no private employer?
No.
So you're speaking on behalf of a large group, but no particular private employer like Ms. McConaughey, who is?
Well, that's right. That's right. We come from different viewpoints.
And so what's the posture for the Alaska retired public employees as it relates to private employers and the exposure they may have? Do you have a position for that particular group?
You know, I think that we are actually very sympathetic to a lot of the positions here that are here. And I know I can't speak about myself personally. I can only speak for them. But I do think there is a lot of concern over a national plan. And so I don't think that's really the point here, Mr. Chair. I think the point really is closing off the possibility of options of working further on down the line if we do something with an amendment on the Constitution. I think that's really the point. It's not so much that we don't go along with some of this, that we're not sympathetic with it, and I'm not sure that all of us want the government completely in our lives. But I think it's the idea of what are we going to do with amending the Constitution.
I appreciate that. Can you profile for me Group A and Group B? Let's say that Group A was the previous person that testified, who's a private sector employee,
right.
And Group B is the group of Alaska retired public employees. Looking forward, what is the exposure to each group if we have mandated health insurance? What is the exposure horizon for both groups?
If we have mandated? Well, I think, of course, the biggest exposure would be to Peggy McConaughey and her group. Obviously, that is the largest exposure. Ours is fairly protected at this time. It's just a matter of how we do it. What is the procedure? What is the process of doing it?
Yes, ma'am. So your sense is that there's considerable exposure for private employers and far less exposure for public members of public employee retirement
Absolutely.
System?
Absolutely. You're right. You're right.
Okay. Excellent. Any other questions for members of the committee? Representative Lynn and then Holmes?
No.
Holmes and then Lynn?
No. But first of all, Representative Gall, I miss you on my State Affairs Committee. It was a delight to have you on that committee. This HJR 35, this is basically a thing that says you have a choice to take it or not take it. Is that correct?
That's what it says. That's right.
You always told me you were pro-choice.
Funny. I'm going to take you out for a cocktail, Representative.
Put that on the record.
I owe you.
The way to my vote is through a cocktail.
That's wonderful.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess I'm gonna sound a bit like a broken record today.
Don't worry.
Thank you. I'm looking at this at the bottom of page one, and it says no law shall be passed that prohibits a person from or that penalizes a person from making direct payments to a health care provider. That's Medicare. I understand that's the system that we're in right now, but one of the things, I feel like we're having this debate in the context of what's happening this year. And the debate, and there is going to be a question in here somewhere, Mr. Chairman. I feel like we're having this debate in reaction to things that are happening on the national scene right now, and a legitimate fear by a lot of people. I think it's a very legitimate fear, depending on how healthcare reform is worded. There are winners and there are losers. And I guess my fear is that we are doing a bit of a knee-jerk reaction. Medicare is something that we all realize is broken in many ways. Medicare, Medicaid, VA, tribal health are all issues that I think a lot of people, they may debate how it should be fixed or how it should be amended, but I think there's widespread agreement that going forward these programs are going to have to change and be amended. I'm reading this language to tie our hands on that debate, not just in an effort to protect ourselves against the immediate fear of national health care reform. I think that something like this would really tie our hands on some of these others that I think there's widespread agreement need mm-hmm. to change. And I guess the question, Mr. Chairman, is if that's sort of what I heard Representative Dahl saying, is that what you
That's exactly
where you guys are headed, where the employees are worried. Because Medicare, retired public employees are all under the Medicare system. They're required to enroll in Medicaid once they're eligible in order to have that. And that is where something like this could really affect the retired public employees. Am I reading this correctly?
No, and you are right. And I'm thinking what they're simply saying is that they recognize this is an emotional issue. Mm-hmm. And they recognize that there's a knee-jerk reaction to this. And we all have these. I mean, all of us. I mean, even right now, I turn on TV and I have an emotional reaction to some things. One minute I say, oh, that's great. And the next minute I say, no, it can't be that way. So, I mean, I understand this. I guess what we're really saying is let's not cut off our options. Huh? Let's not close off these options. Let's keep them open. And I think the best way to doing that is not passing this resolution, not putting this into the Constitution, or even trying to. I mean, it only creates more of that emotion. And I think that someone just said something about that this is likely to cause legal conflict. And probably there are going to be lawsuits because of it. That doesn't solve anything. All it does is, I'm not sure what it does, frankly, by having more lawsuits.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Representative Dahl. It's so nice to have you here. I wish that you would find more issues that are of interest to you, because I like having you here, truly. Truly. Can we go offline to Pat Luby with AARP, please? Pat?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Pat Luby. I'm the Advocacy Director for AARP in Alaska. AARP is opposed to House Joint Resolution 35. We do not feel that the Alaska Constitution should be amended except for very serious reasons. The issues addressed by HJR 35 do not exist and may not in the future. No one knows what Congress may do, and we feel Alaska should keep its options open, especially on an issue as serious as health care. Although Alaska does not have managed care in the HMO model using capitated cost, we do have new models that do manage care. Healthcare now and in the future will be all about networks and coordinated delivery of services, pay for performance, paying physicians and hospitals for more quality care, medical homes, not paying providers for what's referred to as never events, which Medicare is already doing and is being picked up as a model by Medicaid and private insurers. This will only increase in the future. Cost containment is going to be the main focus of healthcare debate in the future. In Alaska, we must do something about the uninsured. Currently, 17% of Alaskans between the ages of 50 and 64 have no insurance at all. When they need health care, they often end up in the emergency room, the most expensive place to get it. They also usually cannot pay their bill. Those of us that do have insurance end up picking up their tab. The average cost of the uninsured for every Alaskan family is $1,900 annually. Employers, including the state of Alaska, also pick up the cost of those employers who do not provide coverage to their employees. AARP wants to make sure that all of us participate in health care coverage so we can end this cost shifting. HJR 35 would allow people to opt out of coverage. The rest of us would still be stuck with their bills. We look to our legislators to provide solutions to problems. Why close down this option that might be very helpful to Alaska in the future? We recommend a nay vote on HJR 35. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for your testimony, Pat. So, Pat, it's Jay Rammer. So if I understand correctly, then you want to force all those people between the ages of 50 and 64 to have to go buy health insurance.
Excuse me, Representative Chair. It's not just the people between 50 and 64. We think it's doing some type of coverage where everyone participates and no one has to pick up someone else's bill is a sensible way for us to do this.
I understood, Pat, but you just indicated that there were a large percentage of people between the ages of 50 and 64 who don't have any health insurance. How are they going to acquire health insurance?
Well, if the national model is picked up, and we think something's going to be done at the national level, people would either be able to join some type of a pool, they'd be able to get into some type of an exchange, but there would, if you don't pay for your own health insurance or your employer does not pay for it, there would be penalties. And those are, the penalties are there because they're incentives to get people to actually purchase the coverage and make sure that all of us have some type of basic coverage.
Pat, lucky for you, Marie Darling just showed up, and she's a rock star in testimony. So, you're in better. Your position has just been enhanced.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Representative Gatto has a question. And Marie, we passed the health registry bill. Well, we did, and then we didn't, but we will. So I'm a little bit intimidated by you, so I'm very mindful when you come into the room. Representative Gatto has a question for Pat Luby while Marie warms up.
Pat, did you use the word knee-jerk reaction?
I don't believe so. Through the chair, no, Representative Gatto, I don't believe so.
Okay, well then, never mind.
Are there other questions? Other questions for Pat? Pat, I want to point out to you, I told you when we were at the LUSAC Library that when AARP testifies, they're more interested in killing bills rather than seeing their passage. Pat and I, we had a very constructive debate we shared on the 90-day session, and he said there wasn't enough time to pass legislation. And I pointed out when I was on the stage, I said, Pat, if my recollection serves me, when AARP shows up, most of the time they're interested in killing legislation rather than seeing it go through. So, Pat, it is a pleasure to have you before the committee.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, this is the first bill that we're opposing in this session. We're supporting all the other ones.
Yes, sir.
All the other ones.
Yes, sir. All right. Seeing no questions, Pat, we thank you very much for your testimony today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we'd like to go next to Dave Rowland. Dave?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
If you'd introduce yourself and your affiliation for the record, please.
Be happy to. My name is Dave Rowland, and I am with the Show Me Institute, which is a free market think tank based in Missouri.
Do you have testimony to offer?
I do. I believe that I provided written testimony that I've been told should be available to the committee. And then I'll just introduce myself a little bit. I'm a constitutional attorney. I cut my teeth in Washington, D.C. with a group called the Institute for Justice, litigating federal and state constitutional cases across the country. And so I've built a little bit of expertise on this issue, which is why I've been asked to speak with the committee today. And I thank you very much for this opportunity. I'd like to start off just by talking about the question that I've heard already today, and that's whether this effort would be premature. I've heard this from a number of state legislatures, and my perspective on that is that in the last 20 years, there have been a couple of major pushes at the federal level to pass health care reforms that would dramatically impact the rights of individual citizens to make these determinations for themselves about health care, where they're going to obtain it, and how they're going to pay for it. In addition to this, you've already had Massachusetts pass the kind of an individual health insurance mandate that is being anticipated in the bill before Congress right now, and at least six other states have considered similar individual mandates. So the way that I look at this is if people are concerned about the possibility of being forced to purchase insurance that they do not want, then now might be the time to try and take action on this front. It's kind of like if you hear that there are strangers in your neighborhood trying doors, that's the time to buy a lock. And from my perspective, the Healthcare Freedom Act would give Alaskans the opportunity to decide for themselves whether, in fact, they think that this is something. They think that these are rights that need to be protected.
Dave, if you could, we do have your written testimony. If you could focus your comments on Alaskans rather than giving us a tutorial on Massachusetts and the remainder states. Have you visited Alaska before?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I've been to Anchorage, Fairbanks, Barrow. I kind of cross the central part of the state up and down.
Thank you. You've just bought yourself a few more minutes. Well done.
All right.
Fair enough.
My expertise is constitutional law, and so I'd just like to say one of the other questions that I hear frequently is what effect is an amendment like this likely to have? First off, it would, in fact, for certain prevent the state from imposing kind of a Massachusetts-style healthcare mandate. But the more pressing question is how would it affect the implementation of the federal healthcare bill that's currently being considered. That's a little bit more of an open question. There is a supremacy clause in the federal constitution that says that, generally speaking, when there's a conflict between a federal statute and even a state constitutional provision, the federal statute usually wins out. However, in recent years, the U.S. Supreme Court has indicated a certain discomfort with allowing federal statutes to trump state protections. And so there's reason to believe that if there was a conflict between, say, a federal health care statute and rights secured under a state constitutional amendment, that the courts might well choose to protect the rights secured under the state constitution. That will, of course, be decided in the courts. But passage of the Alaska version of the Healthcare Freedom Amendment would give Alaskans the opportunity to seek the protection of those rights in the courts.
Okay, can we?
And at this point, I'll be happy to take any questions about either the constitutionality of the federal bill or the implications of the bill that's under consideration in Alaska.
Perfect. Are there any questions for Mr. Rowland? Mr. Rowland, I don't see questions at the committee table. We do appreciate your testimony. It is embedded in the record, and I think points of view on this issue, like across the country, are pretty polarized here at the committee room.
Okay. If anyone has any further questions, feel free to email me. I believe I have my email address in the written testimony.
I believe it is, and we thank you for testifying before our committee. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you.
Come back to Alaska.
Marie, did you wish to testify? You're just here to... All right, very well. We like having you, though. We enjoy when you offer testimony. How about Christy Herrera? Christy, are you with us with the American Legislative Exchange Council? Please, if you'd introduce yourself and your affiliation for the record.
Yes, hi, Mr. Chair. My name is Christy Herrera, and I'm Director of the Health and Human Services Task Force for ALEC. We are a nonpartisan nationwide association of lawmakers with over 1,800 members across the country and several dozen in Alaska. We applaud HJR 35, which is modeled after our own Freedom of Choice in Healthcare Act, now in actually 38 states rather than 35, so that number is growing. We applaud this bill for three key reasons. One, we believe this bill will ensure continued access to health services. We believe that when government controls healthcare dollars, they make treatment decisions based on what's best for government. And we believe that patients, not bureaucrats, should decide what's best for patients. The second reason why we applaud this bill is because it would stop mandates that just don't work. We know it's important for people to have health insurance coverage, but a government requirement to purchase it is ineffective, bureaucratic, and costly. The issue of Massachusetts has come up. They've had an individual mandate since 2006. What has happened there? Well, a third of their uninsured still don't have coverage. Health insurance costs 40% more there than in the rest of the country. It's harder for the newly insured. It's harder for the newly insured to see a doctor, and legislators there expect a $2 to $4 billion shortfall over the next decade. This bill would help shield Alaska from a federal individual mandate. As Dave mentioned, this bill would render unconstitutional any state attempt to impose an individual mandate or any state attempt to prohibit direct payment for medical care. The bill will also cause a federalism clash if Congress passes a law with either of these provisions, and that is something that the Supreme Court has recently ruled in the favor of states to protect the individual freedoms of their citizens. If I could just back clean up with some of the misconceptions I heard from the other folks. One is that perhaps this bill might exacerbate the free rider problem in which people show up in the ER and they freely choose not to get care. The problem is that free riders will actually continue to show up for free care with or without a mandate. Again, we have data from Massachusetts, which has an individual mandate, that says since 2006, their emergency room usage has actually increased by 17%. And even if a mandate did solve the free rider problem, we would still be forced to pay for the newly insured with subsidies to purchase the required insurance. Under federal proposals, a low-income family of four would qualify for more than $20,000 in government subsidies. As far as the person that said that fear elicits an exaggerated response, I think that's true, and that's true with in the case of will we lose Medicaid funding, will we lose VA funding or Medicare funding. That's not the case at all. This bill has nothing to do with Medicaid or Medicare. To my knowledge, state law can't affect Medicare, which is a purely federal program. And in fact, if I'm not mistaken, Medicaid is a federal entitlement, and people who are entitled to Medicaid services can take legal action against the federal government because it is a federal entitlement. As far as tying off your hands to future policy options or closing off different legislative measures, I don't think that's the case at all. HJR 35 would just ensure that the cornerstone of any future reform is the preservation of patients' rights. Someone mentioned no one knows what Congress may do. We actually do know what they'll do. If you look at the Kaiser Family Foundation, that has a side-by-side comparison of both the House and the Senate bills. Both the House and Senate bills would have an individual mandate that the Cato Institute estimates would require more than 100 million Americans to drop their existing coverage and buy more expensive coverage that they might not want or need. As Dave mentioned, there is a bipartisan effort in the states. At least six states have considered an individual mandate at the state level. So with that, I just want to conclude by saying we applaud HJR 35, and I would be happy to take anyone's questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Christy? Christy, seeing none, we thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Is there anybody else in the room who wishes to testify? Anybody else online that wishes to testify? All right. So with that, public testimony is closed. We'll bring the bill back before the committee. Are there any issues, any amendments, any changes that we would like to make to this bill? Are we ready to bring the bill to a motion?
Yep.
Okay. So we'll take a brief at ease. Okay. 25 with us is Representative Gruenberg. Representative Gruenberg, we have taken testimony on HJR 35 from Peggy Ann McConaughey with the NFIB, who was in favor of HJR 35, with our colleague, Representative Andrea Dahl, who testified against the bill on behalf of the Alaska retired public employees. We also heard from Pat Luby with the AARP, and we heard from Dave Rowland with the Show Me Institute, a conservative think tank. He testified in favor of HJR 35, and Christy Herrera with ALEC, to which Alaska belongs, indicated there are 38 states that have similar legislation proposed. We have brought the bill back for committee discussion. Do you have any remarks you'd like to have read onto the record?
No, just to thank you. I was in another committee.
Are you out of breath? A little?
Better to be out of it than none at all. No, I have no questions.
All right.
And thank you for letting me be here for that.
Our pleasure.
Discussion and vote.
All right. So with that, the chair would entertain a motion. Representative Alston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wish to move House Joint Resolution number 35-26-LS1063/R with attached physical note and individual recommendations from committee.
Thank you. And seeing no objection, HJR 35 passes from committee. And we'll just take a brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record. It's 2:30. Before us is Representative Max F. Gruenberg, Jr. Representative Gruenberg, I have my amendment package prepared, and we are delighted to hear from you. Representative, House Bill number 355.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I seriously appreciate very much your hearing the bill. It's a bill that was based upon...
It's not 355? Oh, I'm sorry.
Which one are you doing?
289.
I'm on 289.
Oh,
that's different.
Yep.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had 355 before me. Susan, I'm sorry.
If you don't mind.
Oh, this bill. I don't want to do this bill. I want to do 355. I'm mentally prepared for 355. I have not considered 289. I apologize.
Okay, well, can we do...
Sorry, 355 was the bill that we introduced yesterday, correct?
Yes.
So I presumed that we were proceeding with 355. And we will introduce 289 today, but I haven't Oh, I see. So all, these are the people that wish to speak on 289.
I've got Eddie here. And,
okay.
Okay. Okay, we're ready to go.
Okay, ready to roll?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I'm Max Gruenberg. I represent House District 20 in Anchorage, Mountain View, Russian Jack, and Turpin. And I thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for hearing House Bill 355. This is a bill that is designed to bring our criminal fines for organizations, corporations, partnerships, that sort of thing, in line with the current economy and to close potential loopholes. We have the bill itself and the amendment, number E1. And if I may have a little bit of loophole. I want to call the client of mine Mr. Jolamian. This isn't quite that bad. This is designed to close a loophole in the law. And let me tell you, if I may, have a little leeway, Mr. Chair, to do explain the bill and possibly the amendment. The bill itself, as you can see, is designed with a corporation. You cannot imprison a corporation. You can imprison the officers of the corporation. And by the way, there's a very good law review article in your packet that really explains very clearly the criminal liability of a corporation or their organization, and I commend it to you. We don't get many bills dealing with the responsibility of an organization for criminal activity and how the law deals with that. And I can't think of, well, at one time we had some on pollution law, but aside from that, I can't think of anything we've ever done on this, in my experience. The fine that you levy on a corporation is the maximum of the dollar amounts in number one here on page one, lines 7 to 11, 6 to 11. Or the other alternatives are 2, which is 3 times the pecuniary gain realized by the defendant as the result of the offense, or 3 times the pecuniary damage or loss.
The pecuniary, just for the record, means money.
Yeah, thank you. The money, the gain or loss. The problem is, and I'm going to use an example of the Vico case, just because it presented a paradigm example of a loophole in the law. There was allegedly bribes offered, and the crimes were committed when the bribes were offered. The money was offered to the defendants, the individual legislators. However, the purpose of the alleged bribe was to stop a tax, to vote against the tax, despite their efforts to pass the tax passed. So there was no gain to the corporation, and there was no loss, in that case, to the state. So what this does, Mr. Chair, is to close the loophole by stating that it would be or the gain sought by the defendant or the gain or the loss sought by the defendant for the victim. And that would cover this potential loophole. That was the bill originally, very simply. And if I may have a little leeway to talk about the amendment since I'm here.
To talk about what?
The amendment since I'm here. Can I talk about that too? To save a little time?
Oh, yes.
Well,
okay.
Representative Lynn?
Well, I before we go on to the amendment,
yeah,
if I may, Mr. Chair, we're talking about potential gain or loss, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In the Vico case, for example. How would, and that involved a tax thing. And in what happened, the tax passed. But how do we calculate the gain or the loss to Vico, as one example, in that case? How do you determine how much might they have gained as a result of that? How much might they lose? I mean, how do you get your hands around it? What's the price we're all going to be today, tomorrow, next year? Who knows?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. May I respond?
Yes, please.
In some cases, it might be difficult to utilize that, and you would be left to the money damages listed in subsection 1. In some cases, though, you could use that amount, and I think that there was evidence that was presented to the legislature in the course of hearings and testimony as to the amount the tax was calculated that it would have brought in.
It was sought.
Yeah, that it was sought. So in that particular case, there was evidence in the legislative record that would have supported it, and there were witnesses who would have been able to testify. It would be, in that case, I think probably a little easier to have calculated it under subsection 3, the potential loss to the state. In other cases, there would be evidence on the potential gain to the defendant. But that's just one example of how it could have operated in this case. And in some cases, you're right, this wouldn't be usable. And that's why they have these various alternatives that the prosecution can pick and choose between, and the jury can.
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lynn?
In the case we were talking about here, would the gain or loss have been for a year, for 2 years, 5 years, 20 years, however long the tax, I mean, very different figures.
That's correct. And the judge, first of all, the amount of the gain or loss, that is a problem that could be dealt with in an individual case. There's a statute of limitations, and there you can go back 5 years under the general statute of limitations. But the court would be able to establish a reasonable period of time. That would have been a prospective situation, and at some point it would become too speculative. But they certainly would be able to determine what the potential loss to the state would have been, say, for a year or two. At some point, they would cut it off. But it depends on the facts of the circumstances, I guess.
Thank you.
Representative Grunberg, before we move on to the amendment, which really just appears to be about numbers. So before we move on to the amendment, which appears just to be, seems to be about monetary values.
Right.
My question for you is on page 2, lines 1 and 2. Sought by the defendant, for the defendant, or for others by the commission of the offense. Who is the defendant?
Well, if I may I respond?
Well, yeah, I asked you the question.
Okay. I got to tell folks, you can laugh now, but when you're in the side of the table, it's much tougher.
Well, I'm gonna keep you there for a while.
I know you will.
Mr. Chairman, I can't resist. As I think people felt the same way when there was two co-chairs here, Grunberg and Gall.
We do have a wishing to testify today, Representative Gall. Representative Grunberg.
I'm sorry.
Lines 1 and 2 on page 2. It says three times the pecuniary gain sought by the defendant, or for others by the commission of the offense. So who is the defendant?
I see.
Or for the defendant, or for others?
Okay.
Who are those three entities, please?
If I may use the VICO hypothetical.
Do something else other than VICO? I mean, it just makes my skin crawl. It makes my skin crawl to use them as a hypothetical. Can you use just...
Corporation X.
Thank you.
Perfect.
If Corporation X was the party that stood to gain, then that would be the defendant and for their benefit. If Corporation X was acting on behalf of its clients or people with whom it did business, in this case, other taxpayers, then it could be calculated on how much the client stood to gain. And Mr. Chair, I think it would have been too speculative to have figured in the
others.
No, in the case we're not mentioning. the unmentionable case.
Right, right.
It would have been tough to have determined how much they would have gained. I don't think that would have.
So if I read this like a layperson and I go to page 1, line 14, it says three times the monetary gain realized by corporation X as a result of the offense. So that would be the penalty.
Mm-hmm.
Or sought by the defendant. That would again be the corporation that committed the crime for the defendant, which would mean some other party that would benefit by their actions, or for others, which would be kind of this universe of people that may also benefit.
It would have to have been sought by the defendant for the other.
If it was like rings around a tree or something, there are different entities that would benefit.
Or spokes of a wheel.
Where does the money go?
The money, the fine?
Yeah.
Goes to the state.
Where does it go once it gets to the state?
General fund.
And
like other fines.
Understood. And how often? Do we see this statute? Is there any statute like this on the books now, or is this all new law that you're?
Proposing? Oh no, everything that's not bold and underlined is on the books right now.
Okay. So do you have an example of section 1, A, B, C, and D?
In the law review article, it discusses several cases, reported cases, where this has been used.
And this is our law review here in Alaska?
The Alaska Law Review. Yeah.
Can you cite those for me?
My staff, we should have.
Gretchen, he is so lost without you. Help him, please.
Of course.
pull up, dock up next to him and see if you can help him out.
Yeah,
come
on. And we also have Annie Carpinetti here.
Yeah, but we want Gretchen. Put Gretchen right up there next to you, and she's going to help you out.
If the members would please look at the law review article here,
okay.
Page 185 deals with Alaska jurisprudence,
okay.
And they cite a number of cases.
Representative Grunberg, for those of us that aren't familiar with the law review, we need to figure out how to. 176 is the table of contents.
Yeah. We're on page 6.
Where's the page number? It's page 6?
Yes.
Okay.
And if I could ask Ms. Carpinetti to come up to. She's.
Oh, no. No, no, no. I'm interested in Representative Grunberg right now. I'm enjoying myself.
We call this in the law a gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah. So take me through this a little bit. This is dense for those of us that aren't lawyers.
Okay. There are a couple of cases here that they talk about. One was the ABC towing case, then there was the Arctic Sunrise case, which was the Greenpeace case. And they're talking about, in those cases, they went after the corporations. Do you have the book?
Yeah.
It's much easier for me to use the actual book. But there are several cases, actual cases, if I could have Title 11 over there, James, this statute has been applied in a number of cases here.
Stand by.
Thank you. AS 12.55.035, if I may look at the annotation.
And so I see a case, this Greenpeace case looks like it's cited in 2004.
Yeah.
State versus ABC towing, I don't see a date on that. How often, is this a pretty dusty statute? Do we use it with frequency? Was it used against VECO, for instance?
No, they did not prosecute VECO, and we've tried to find out why.
Okay.
I do not know why they did or didn't.
Okay.
But as you can see,
who did they prosecute last? I mean, how frequently is this statute?
I would really like to have, because all I can do is pull out the books. Could we have Ms.
She's busy.
She's like,
she left.
Okay.
No, she's there. She's there, Max.
Okay. I can't tell you how recently they prosecuted people under this. They only.
Representative Grunberg, it just seems that this prime sponsor, you're just a bit disheveled.
The question, if I have.
I'm just joking, but I really am enjoying myself.
The record should show that.
I just wanted to use that word twice, Susan, so you get it on the record. The prime sponsor seems disheveled. D-I-S-H-E-V-E-L-E-D. Disheveled.
Okay.
Very good, Mr.
Can we have, Ms. Carpenetti answer your question, please? Because I don't know the answers.
Yes, ma'am. Annie, we're delighted to have you before the committee. If you'll introduce yourself for the record, please.
My name is Annie Carpenetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. And I will tell you that we don't prosecute corporations very often under Title 11 for the criminal violations.
So Annie, of all the corporations in Alaska that have given us a black eye since statehood, how could VECO not be prosecuted?
You know, I would have to prepare and get back to you on that because I was not part of the...
So which kind of corporations are prosecuted then? Towing company for pollution discharge?
Well, let's look and see. I mean...
Illegal discharge of gasoline?
Are people in Auspeth who sometimes prosecute corporations are in support of this bill? In those circumstances where they can prosecute a corporation for a criminal act, oftentimes there's pecuniary gain that, and they would support this increase in maximum fines. But it doesn't happen very often.
It appears that the MV Arctic Sunrise failed to file an oil spill plan.
Mr. Chair, if you would look at footnote 66, which is a page 186 of the Law Review article, the Greenpeace case was a 2008 case that was that was the date of the opinion from the Criminal Court of Appeals.
They sailed into state waters without a state-approved oil spill contingency plan. What's the purpose of this bill that we're taking up? Just in the broad brush strokes, what are we doing with 355? What's the point of it?
The point of it is to close a loophole.
What's the loophole?
The loophole where there's no gain or loss, but the crime is complete. And the potential for a gain to the defendant and a loss to the victim is tremendous. And the monetary amount in subsection 1 is now maximum of $1 million, which could be woefully inadequate, and even under the proposed amendment number 1, it would only go up to...
How much did the towing company get? Who did they hurt, and how much did they get fined for the illegal discharge of gasoline? I assume that means they poured gasoline on the ground, probably.
Right? Mr. Chair, I don't know. All I know is they did not report in this the amount of any of these fines.
Okay. Yeah, they didn't report that in the Law Review article.
Not in the Law Review. And, Mr. Chair, the Law Review article was mainly focusing on the liability rather than the damage, rather than the fines.
I understand. You commended us to the Law Review article. So my question for you is, if this piece of legislation was in place, what would it have done to the tow truck company? What would it do to Greenpeace, the two entities that are cited here on page six? Who did they hurt? The tow truck company sounds like they hurt Mother Earth, and the Greenpeace failed to have an oil spill plan, so they also threatened presumably the fishing industry, I assume. I mean, what would this bill do if it were in place? What would it do to ABC Towing, and what would it do to Greenpeace?
Mr. Chair, if I may answer that.
Representative Grunberg.
I can't cite you to the exact footnote, but there was a footnote or something in the Law Review article where they talked about what had to be done in the towing company case. And they had to clean up, and there was a cost of cleanup, which would have been potentially the damage to the owner of the property. Okay. And that was something that could have been trebled. There are provisions, of course, for... what is it called? They can also order. It's forfeit, not forfeiture.
Forfeiture.
So it says. excuse me. It says down here on the bottom of page 6. If I can direct members to the last paragraph, it says collectively, ABC Towing and Greenpeace confirm the existence of organizational criminal liability under state law.
Restitution.
These decisions do little, however, to define the contours and limitations of that liability and, in fact, highlight problems with the existing laws, which I assume is part of the reason why we're here.
Yeah.
ABC Towing carves out an exemption for sole proprietorships. Greenpeace is also problematic in that it illustrates the ease with which organizations might compartmentalize their operations or duplicate themselves and thereby thwart criminal prosecution. These are shortcomings legislators need to address if the prosecution of organizations is to be effectively and consistently utilized. Is that why we're here?
Yes, sir. And if I may, Mr. Sniffen, who prosecutes these cases, is on the line and can, I hope, answer your question. But
I'm enjoying asking the prime sponsor the questions.
I know you are, and I'm loving to answer them, but I want to tell you when I can't answer them, all kidding aside. And
I'm not kidding either. I mean, I'm interested in what we're doing. I don't fully grasp what the purpose of this legislation is.
The purpose is to close the loophole. The article, though, itself suggests other things we need to do with the criminal corporate liability statutes, which is not part of the bill. And I wanted to also put on the record that the court is allowed to order restitution to a victim. And they can do that for criminals as well, but that's not part of the fine that goes to the state. But I would ask if you would like to ask some of these questions to Mr. Sniffen, who has the personal experience that I don't have.
Representative Heron has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Basically following your inquiries is Representative Gruenberg. What is the algorithm or the reasoning behind the numbers in the amendment? I mean, is there some?
Yes. The numbers were suggested by the Department of Law, and we have not had any amendments to increase these numbers in a number of years. Gretchen has the exact dates. Okay. The figures for the misdemeanors, which in the amendment of lines 5 through 15, were enacted in 1990, which was 20 years ago, and the felony 1 million was enacted in 2002, and we've had a significant inflation since that time.
Okay. I want to just make the committee aware we're going to lose Representative Heron at 3 p.m. and Representative Gatto, so we're going to be adjourning in 5 minutes. Representative Gruenberg, I'm fascinated by this. I'm enjoying having you as a sponsor. It pleases me. So I have some questions for you for when we take this piece of legislation up again. I'd like to see a chart of how often this this existing statute has been used. You know, let's say for the last 10 years, how many times we have used this and what penalties it's rendered and what kind of opportunities we have to direct this money in a fashion similar to other pieces of legislation that have come before the committee, such as the Victims Crime Compensation Fund and other entities that I care about, or the Youth Court. Which we were just looking for a funding source for. So I'm interested in both of these issues. But I think I have an understanding now of what the amended language or the bill language on page 2 means, at least portion B, and then portion B on lines 1 and 2, and then I haven't yet turned my attention to lines 6 and 7. And so what I'd like to do is to spend the last 5 minutes asking Mr. Sniffen some questions, and so then when we come back, I'd like to focus on those two things. I'd like to see how often the statute has been used, since it wasn't used for VECO, which is rather astounding to me that it could be used for ABC towing, and then VECO sets Alaska back a quarter century, and we lose our senior senator as a result, and the statute's not used for that. Representative Dahlstrom.
Mr. Chair, I just have one yes or no question for the sponsor. Representative Gruenberg, did the Department of Law request this change?
No, they didn't request the change. I drafted the bill and went to them and asked them their position.
Okay, thank you.
I was thinking that, and we should really ask Mr. Sniffen this, he had suggested to me in a conversation that we raise the monetary limits, and at least for the misdemeanor, and I said, what about for the felony?
Okay, very good. All right, so Mr. Sniffen, would you, we've got about 4 minutes, would you kind of give us an overview of this piece of legislation? Representative Gruenberg has his marching orders for when we bring this bill back before the committee, and then as the final piece of work today, what we will do is we will introduce House Bill 289 so that it can come back as a bill previously heard. Fair enough?
Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Sniffen, are you with us?
I am, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we're so happy to hear you. You're one of my favorite people in the Department of Law. Thank you for looking out for Alaskans all across the state. You're a good man. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Ed Sniffen. I'm with the Department of Law here in Anchorage, and my responsibilities include enforcement of our consumer protection and antitrust statutes, which I've been at for 10 years now. And I'm happy to tell you what I know about, I think, this particular statute, but let me make it clear, I don't do any criminal enforcement. The only criminal aspect of our consumer protection or antitrust statutes that I'm aware of is under our antitrust law, it is a misdemeanor if you violate several of the provisions of the Alaska Restraint of Trade Act. But our antitrust statute contains a very specific criminal penalties section that limits penalties to $20,000 for an individual and $50,000 for a corporation. So that's the section of the law that we would be stuck with if we wanted to penalize someone for an antitrust violation. And it would probably preempt any language in this particular statute, 12.55. So it would have very limited applicability to the cases that we enforce. I believe there has been some efforts in the past to try and raise those limits in our antitrust statute. Just by way of example, when we do our fuel pricing investigations, those are antitrust investigations. If we found any violations, the fines would be severely limited. There would be $50,000 for any kind of price fixing activity we might uncover. So we have tried to get those fines in our antitrust statute raised. As far as this particular bill goes, Representative Gruenberg asked us for some suggestions on increasing these fines. And at the time, I was thinking that the Class A misdemeanor offense here of $200,000 would exceed the $50,000 limit under antitrust statute. But the more I thought about that, the more I understand that our antitrust statute, because it's a more specific statute, would probably control, and this wouldn't apply in any
Mr.
event.
Mr. Sniffen?
Yes, sir.
We're bumping up against the clock. Has this statute been used in the last 10 years? How much in monetary value and fines have we collected using this statute?
Mr. Chairman, I haven't used this statute in my 10 years here at the department, because it's a criminal violation statute, so my answer would be none. But I don't know, maybe Annie knows if the criminal division has done any.
Yes.
I would say yes, we have, but I don't have specifics. I'll be happy to get them for you.
Okay, so Mr. Sniffen, we're going to look forward to coming back and seeing where this leads, and then seeing what we can write into this to see what we can do with the fines, which are the two things that I'm particularly interested in. And are there any final questions for Mr. Sniffen? All right, seeing none, we are going to set HB 355 aside. And Representative Gruenberg, we'd like to introduce House Bill 289. And,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to introduce that and state that it amends the Executive Ethics Act to put into statutory form many of the issues that are addressed in the proposed regulations that the Attorney General promulgated last fall, dealing with two subjects. The payment of transportation costs, or the reimbursement of transportation costs for the families of the governor and lieutenant governor in appropriate cases, and the payment of legal costs and fees for executive employees, anybody from the lowest maintenance person to the governor, when they're exonerated, after they've been exonerated from an ethics complaint. The regulations, I felt, should have been in statute.
Understood.
That should be the job of the legislature, not the executive branch, who are appointed or
Understood. Paid
ultimately through the governor. And secondly, in at least three respects, those regulations, I felt, were too loose. Number one, they could be read as not requiring exoneration. Number two, they could have been potentially read to allow repayment of the costs and fees for a past governor who's out of office. And number three, the procedure for the reimbursement of the costs and fees was very cumbersome. They had provision to get them while the case was going on, and the person might not be exonerated, and then the state would have to go and chase the person back, and it was very convoluted. We simplified all of those, and that's what the bill does.
Outstanding. We appreciate your point of view on that. And is there a companion bill for House Bill 289 moving on the Senate side?
Not that I'm aware.
So on day 52 of the second year of the 26th legislative session, is it your expectation that we can move this through the House and get it over moved through the Senate?
Yes, if your questions are brief.
Touché. So you have me there, Representative Grunberg. On that note, at 2 minutes past 3, we'll adjourn for the day. Thank you.